this is one way of looking at it. I think the eighth week of our introductory course. I think this is the third meeting after the end of the five-week course. And what I want to do this evening is to try to describe the more traditional Buddhist context for the mindfulness practice that we do. Kind of from the core Buddhist teachings that mindfulness practice kind of is traditionally held within. And I think to begin with a simile that the Buddha used. He was walking in the forest one day with his students, and he picked up a handful of leaves from the forest floor, and he asked his students, "What is more, the amount of leaves in my hand, or the number of leaves in the forest on all the trees?" And so his students kind of, well, you know, yeah, there's a lot more, you know, on the forest in all the trees. And the Buddha said, in the same way, the amount of teachings that I teach you compared to what I know is comparative to the amount of leaves in my hand versus all the leaves in the forest. So what he taught, you know, is actually a very small portion of what he could teach, all the things he knew. And I think this is important to realize, that you don't have to know a lot. You don't have to be, you know, tremendously wise in all the different teachings of Buddhism or all the different forms of spirituality or all the metaphysics of, you know, the world or whatever, in order to pursue or study Buddhist practice. And what you need to do to pursue Buddhist practice, what you need to know is actually very little. It's comparatively. The Buddha said once, or maybe several times, he said, "I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering." And this is one of the simplest definitions of what Buddhism is about. You know, this little handful of what it's all about is about this very simple thing, moving from a state of suffering or tension or stress or discomfort or discontent or you know, all the different versions we can call suffering, and moving to a place of happiness, of freedom from suffering, a place then we're available with an open heart to the world in a compassionate, receptive way. And in a sense, our tradition is kind of poverty stricken, because it doesn't have, you know, it just has this handful of stuff. It doesn't have all of, you know, the forest, which some people would get dazzled and lost in the forest, trying to read all the leaves and all the trees. And our tradition is actually very narrow and very simple. And so the focus is to understand suffering and how to become liberated from suffering, how to be free of it, and how to become happy. In a sense, you might say that from this perspective, Buddhism is a form of therapy. You know, it has a lot in common with modern forms of psychotherapy. Now, a lot of Buddhists feel very uncomfortable by that comparison. They want to admit, you know, Buddhism is a religion. It's not a form of therapy, and to call it a form of therapy is to limit it. And the boundaries between therapy and a spiritual practice are kind of getting more diffuse as time goes along here, depending on the school of therapy or in school of spirituality. But certainly, Buddhist practice has a lot more to do with just learning how to cope better in yourself, and how to have a stronger sense of self. Buddhist spirituality, Buddhist therapy has a lot to do with understanding that the very notion of a self, the very notion of a self-identity, itself can be a seed of tremendous suffering. And so it isn't just simply a matter of kind of arranging the furniture on the Titanic, you know, getting a better, you know, sense of self, which therapy can often do, and it's an important thing to do for a lot of people. But in a sense, from a Buddhist point of view, it's important to arrange the furniture on the Titanic, but you have to remember that it's, you know, that's, you're still on the Titanic. And so what Buddhism offers is, in a sense, is to offer you kind of a different boat, a whole different boat that's actually not going to sink. And that boat is not a boat at all, but is the mind which doesn't have within it the tendency to create suffering. So it's very simple, you know, and maybe it's too simple. It sounds like maybe it's not so spiritual. And people get dazzled by the great spiritual descriptions of, you know, great angelic states and great states of rapture and great experiences of white light or great states of wonderful purity or great psychic abilities, all kinds of great things that you can get sidetracked by. Buddhism, again, is very much simpler, and in a sense it's more radical and maybe even more difficult. It's considered to be more difficult to become free of suffering totally than it is to develop psychic powers. So you can choose, you know, if you want to do something easier, you go develop psychic powers. Now, I guess saying that, I guess you can get discouraged. And that wasn't my intention. you know, you just talk impromptu, you don't know what comes out. So a lot of the Buddhist teachings are from different vantage points, kind of pointing back or pointing at the importance of this very moment, of our practice and our awareness and wakefulness in this very moment, and the choices we make in this very moment. And in a summary, the suffering that we have occurs in the present moment by conditions or causes that are also happening in the present moment. And that there's certainly momentum to past suffering and past conditions that hurt us in the present. But as you really study the mind at the detailed level, you know, refined, subtle levels of the mind, we begin realizing that it's in the present moment that the dynamics of suffering get recreated over and over and over again. And so what Buddhist practice tries to do is to develop the kind of mindfulness, strength of mindfulness, that really can begin penetrating understanding the subtle movements of the mind and the heart in the present moment, that in the present moment is creating our suffering. And that's a radical... Buddhism offers something very, very radical. It offers the same kind of healing that can happen through some forms of psychoanalysis where you go back and review the past. It can heal the same kind of things by a very deep, penetrating understanding of the dynamics that are occurring in the present moment around the same suffering. In the sense that we recreate the same thing over and over again in the present moment. And by understanding what we do in the present moment, there is an opportunity to become free from that particular suffering. So the famous Indian teaching of karma, for example, is popularly in India and also popularly in the West, taken to mean what you do in the future past will come back to you in the future. It's your karma. Means that it's your inheriting, you know, the results of your past actions. And there can be kind of deterministic notion around the notion of karma. You did certain thing in the past, therefore this will happen in the present, this will happen in the future. The Buddha actually shied very strongly away from deterministic understandings of karma. He said if karma is deterministic, where the action will always result in a particular result, then there's no space, no room for spiritual life. There's no room for movement towards freedom. You know, if everything's predetermined by what you did in the past. So the Buddha reinterpreted karma, or the word karma, and defined karma as intention in the present moment. Your intention in the present moment is your karma. What your choice you make in the present moment sets into motion what's going to happen in the next moment, what's going to happen tomorrow, what's going to happen next year. In the karmic kind of way that karmic patterns develop and unfold. So by redefining it as intention in the present moment, it was another way in which the Buddha was saying, really the key to your life is in the present moment. And this is where we need to wake up. Another vantage point that he wanted to kind of say the same thing, and this is really the subject for today's talk, is the Four Noble Truths. And this is in some sense the key and core Buddhist teaching. If you want to know what is the Buddhist teaching, you really, you know, if you wanted the core of it, and that almost all Buddhist traditions will agree with, is what's called the Four Noble Truths. And truths in this sense is not philosophical truths. It's not like this great metaphysical truth that if you understand these truths, you understand the truths of the universe in a sense. It's more, I see it more as being therapeutically true or pragmatically true, maybe therapeutically true, these truths. They're very important because Buddhism is interested in suffering and freedom from suffering, and these are the kind of very important understandings or framework to understand our life that really can help us see the possibility of becoming free of suffering. So the first of the noble truths, and part of the beauty, I think, of the Buddha putting the Four Noble Truths at the center of his spiritual teachings, is he offers a spiritual practice without any offering of metaphysical beliefs. The Four Noble Truths exist independent of whether there is or isn't a God, independent of whether there is or isn't rebirth, independent of whether there is or isn't some kind of ultimate spiritual destination, you know, in the future, you know, or in some kind of transcendental realm. The Four Noble Truths is really independent of any kind of metaphysical claim that, you know, we say, well, how can I really know? Or, you know, maybe we take it just, we believe it on faith, but it's just faith. We can't really know for ourselves. So it's beautiful that this, a core spirit... I haven't said them yet. You have to be patient. So these four are very, I think, very significant and offer, it's very remarkable that he would offer a spiritual kind of core teaching in this kind of way. So the Four Noble Truths, the first is that in this world that we live in, suffering does occur. It didn't say that everything is suffering. It is suffering occurs in this world. And it'd be, some people will argue that that's really true or not. But most people, I think, it's fairly obvious that without some kind of metaphysical kind of play of mirrors, it's, you know, there's a tremendous amount of suffering in this world. I mean, it's astounding how much suffering is. It's just part of the vision that gets born as a person deepens their mindfulness practice and becomes more awakened is a more powerful understanding of the degree to which this world is a sea of suffering. Tremendous amount. I mean, we read the papers, there's a lot of suffering. But as we begin understanding our own mind and the amount of suffering, the amount of tension and clinging and fear and hatred that exists in our own mind, and realize that most other people's minds are exactly the same. Wow, there is a tremendous amount of suffering at the subtle psychological level. And these, is it 5 billion people we have now in this world? You know, all of them suffering, you know, the same kind of subtle ways all the time. It's phenomenal. It's bad enough just to read the paper and realize, you know, how terrible it is. So this is not supposed to be a bummer of a teaching. What it's meant to be is a realistic statement. And some people find it oppressive to hear this, run away. And some people find it to be very liberating, very inspiring to come to a religious tradition, to hear a kind of teaching that really acknowledges, yeah, there is a lot of suffering, there's a lot of pain in this world. And, you know, I don't have to pretty it up, I don't have to try to have some kind of metaphysical belief that kind of denies it, or have some kind of strange metaphysical belief that offers some hope in the future that kind of softens the suffering right now. But yeah, let's just confront it, let's just call it for what it is. There's a lot of suffering here. And wow, and I've heard people come to me and say, you know, I come to hear a Buddhist teacher, and for the first time I feel, yes, someone understands. Everybody else is in denial. And here, you know, how many of you watched the addiction program, Bill Moyers? I didn't watch it. But did he give any numbers for how many people in America suffer from addiction? You'd think so in 3 hours. Is that all? 1 in 10, you know. So an addiction often arises because people are often, not always, people, there's something, they're uncomfortable at some level of discomfort. They're uncomfortable at some level of suffering in their present life. And addiction is sometimes an attempt to escape that discomfort, to get away from it, to avoid it. So this thing really, to be really realistic about our suffering and the suffering in the world, is considered in Buddhism to be a truth. It's considered in Buddhism to be kind of a sacred thing, actually. It's a sacred kind of thing. To realize that we're suffering, you can say, well, that's a drag to suffer. But from a Buddhist point of view, there's something sacred, something special, there's something respectful, worthy about not the suffering itself, but the recognizing, this is suffering. So Buddhists will try very hard never to turn away from suffering wherever they see it, whether they see it in themselves or see it in the world around them. A Buddhist, as a Buddhist, is someone who actually has a commitment not to turn away from suffering, but to really meet suffering honestly and see this is what's going on in the present moment. Not to deny it, to pull away from it, not to pretty it over or whatever we might do. Just, this is what's happening, there's suffering. So the First Noble Truth is this kind of neutral statement, in a sense, that there is suffering. Suffering occurs in this world. The Second Noble Truth is a discussion of what the cause of this, that there's a cause to this suffering. And the cause of suffering is defined by this one word, which is in Pali, which is tanha, T-A-N-H-A, which is translated literally into English as thirst. When you're thirsty, you have tanha, you have thirst. And sometimes it's translated into English as desire, but that problematizes all desire. Desire itself doesn't cause suffering, but it's anxious desire which causes suffering. When there's clinging or anxiety or fear or desperation or holding on tight to the desire, demanding the desire get fulfilled. There's all these ways in which we get involved in desire, which is more than just a desire. We can just let the desire be there, or we can kind of get anxious behind it and get driven by it or something. Driven desire maybe is a good definition of tanha. It's driven desire which the Buddha in the Four Noble Truths claims is the cause of suffering. And this is where, in my understanding, it gets a little bit subtle. How I understand it is it's a little bit like this. The kind of suffering that the Buddha is talking about in the First Noble Truth is the kind of suffering that's born from driven desire. And therefore, you can say, well, the cause of it is driven desire. It kind of loops around in itself. It's kind of, it's called sometimes in logic, a tautology, I think. But the distinction the Buddha wants to make is a distinction between between pain and suffering. There is also pain in the world, and there's suffering. And this is a different way of using the words than probably most of you use it. So you have to kind of allow for a shift in definitions to understand this. Pain is what happens when we're alive. There is physical pain. There's pain that happens in life. If you stub your toe, there's physical pain. That's pain. If you stub your toe and call yourself a klutz, you've added suffering to that pain. If someone dies and you feel grief, that's pain. If you feel grief and then you feel embarrassed because you're grieving, you've added suffering to it. Suffering is the addition of something extra on top of our experience of being alive, which causes a contraction or a tightness or pain. But it is not there in and of itself, in the experience itself. It arises because we've entered into the experience with a relationship that, in its kind of simplistic definition, is called tanha, is called thirst. But that involves such things as, desire has all kinds of forms and shapes. It means, clinging for something. It means having tremendous aversion for something, pulling away tightly and contracting. It means pushing at something and striking at it. There's all kinds of ways in which this thing drivenness takes place. Yesterday, I had to do a lot of different things, including getting to the hospital. My sister's in the hospital, and so I was kind of literally being driven all over the Bay Area by my car and my concerns. And it was 5:30 in the evening, and I had to find out which hospital she was in. She was being moved from hospitals. So I stopped at a gas station in San Rafael, Larkspur Landing kind of, and called my wife to find out if she knew which hospital she'd been moved to. And he didn't know. He said, well, I'll go have dinner. Because, and after I have dinner, I'll call you back. Maybe then they've called you and told you where she is. I said, great. So we were, you know, I was parked there next to the payphone at the gas station. And happened to be just next to where I parked was the air pump. I thought, I have lots of time now, and I never checked the air in my tires, so why don't I just check them now? So after all, I just bought some gas at the gas station, so I felt some right to go and help myself with the air. So I went and started pumping up air, and my front tire, part of the edges of it were completely bald down to the metal kind of wires that are kind of supported, and they were beginning to fray and actually cut my fingers because I was put my hand over, I think thumb over the. And I don't know, if I'd gotten them back on the freeway, probably the tire would have torn apart because it was really down to very little. So that's just life. That's just stuff. You know, it slows you down. Maybe, you know, but there's no suffering inherent in that. It's just, oh, look at that tire. It's a tire. It's kind of bald. What was interesting to me is what I did in reaction to that. And I did two very interesting movements. They kind of happened at a little bit different times, but the juxtaposition of them was very insightful for me. One of the first reactions was an interpretation, was, oh my God, one more thing, the whole universe is coming down on me, it's just left and right, my computer's breaking, and my flat tire, and this and that, and oh, and now I'm not going to get to the hospital, and I just, you know, now it's 5:30, and how in the world can I get to find a place that's open now, and you know, I have to get 4 new tires, and if I go to a gas station, it cost me a fortune, and oh, one more thing, you know, oh, so oppressive, life's so oppressive, and you know, you know, something like that. And I, you know, probably you kind of have some sense of what I mean. You could resonate with something. It's once upon a time, maybe you felt something like this, and maybe. And you know, and so there was some suffering involved in all this interpretation of things. And then a little bit later I realized, wow, this was pretty great that I discovered this. Imagine if I hadn't discovered this. I could have, you know, it could have exploded on the Golden Gate Bridge and I could have been in the bottom of the canal by now. You know, the tire would have exploded, the car would have popped over the railing and you know, and Or something interesting, right? This is really great. It was really great that I had to make his phone call. I just happened to be right next to this gas air pump, and I happened to check, and wow, this really saved me a lot of grief, and wow, this is a really great thing, and I felt kind of happy. Both of them were interpretations of the event. Both of them were gratuitous. But the event didn't require any of those interpretations. You know, just, oh, it's a flat tire, and I mean, a bald tire, and sensible thing to do now is to get some other tires and let's get to work and find them. But one interpretation made me kind of very painful and suffering, and the other interpretation kind of brought some kind of joy. But they're both interpretations. Actually, not having either interpretation, just kind of taking care of things, was actually kind of a deeper level of satisfaction than the kind of joy of relief. But the suffering arose because I contracted around a whole series of interpretations that I kind of, and resistance to interpretations, and motivations I had about getting somewhere and getting something done, and I had all these desires that I was driven by, and having to stop and take care of this tire thing was interfering with my drivenness, my agenda. The suffering was arising because of this what I was being driven by, this, and the world did not require me to be driven by anything. But I had added this to the situation, and that is that was suffering, and the cause of that suffering was that kind of drivenness. So when Buddhism talks about the Four Noble Truths, the suffering of Four Noble Truths, they're talking about that kind of suffering that we add to the situation, where the situation itself doesn't require that level of suffering in and of itself there. It doesn't mean that then we go through, if we become free of all suffering, which Buddhism is kind of a promise for, it doesn't mean all pain, which is the bad news. You know, we want to have a religious tradition that, you know, we live happily ever after. What Buddhism offers which I think is a very radical thing, and also very realistic. It offers us a practice to become mindful of the cause of suffering in the present moment, the clinging and the contraction and the hate in the present moment that is causing our suffering in the present moment. And understanding that and being honest about it and penetrating that then leads to what is the good news in Buddhism, which is a third noble truth, which is that there's a cessation of suffering, there's the end of suffering. It's possible to end this kind of suffering. You don't have to be stuck with this kind of suffering forever. You don't have to live in the mire of this kind of suffering. That it's possible to become free of it. Now, this is a nice thing to know. This is nice to know that. But to be inspired by that possibility is a whole different thing. To be inspired that this is something that's really worthwhile for a human being. To move in the direction of becoming free of all the gross and subtle ways, and mostly it's a lot of subtle ways, in which we add a kind of drivenness to the situation that causes us suffering, or causes us stress, or causes us strain, or causes us tension. And it's, for many of us, it's the small movements of clinging that add accumulatively through the day that create kind of a lot of suffering and strain for us. But to be inspired that there's a possibility of being free of that, and feeling this is really a useful thing and a worthwhile thing to want to do, is part of the function, I think, of the Four Noble Truths, is really to have that kind of motivation, inspiration, to feel the possibility of that. And often, see, most people, I think, are often motivated or oriented towards some version of their drivenness. And some of the drivenness looks really good. It actually looks kind of maybe healthy. It looks, you know, like, and so we say, well, yes, I want to be free of suffering, but what I really want to do is have a lot of money. What I really want to do is own my own house. What I really want to do is be in a relationship. Yes, it's good to be free of suffering, but what I really want to do is, you know, cling another way. Exactly. What I really want to do is cling another way. That's really worthwhile. So and then Buddhism says, you know, you don't have to cling, but wait a minute. And then we feel, then we notice, I'm really insecure. And part of the reason we're clinging in another way is we're so afraid of not holding on to something. And that itself, that holding on, that fear is another form of this extra suffering we add. And the radicalness of this thoroughgoing cessation of all clinging is we also let go of all holding to security. And that offers a different kind of security when you don't need to have any security. So the possibility of being free of suffering, and that's to be happy, to be liberated, to be... In Buddhism, we call it enlightened, but maybe that's an English word that causes problems for many of us in the West, because enlightened kind of lends itself to kind of our fantasies about what things... But the cessation of suffering is not the kind of mild thing. It's not this neutral thing. It's actually a phenomenal... It is a phenomenal experience. The more thoroughly we do it, the more tremendous is the sense of joy, of well-being, of... the experience actually cannot be described. When it's thoroughly... When the causes of this kind of suffering is thoroughly put to rest, the kind of joy or the kind of presence that is born or that shines cannot actually be kind of described in words what it really is. So it's very hard then to offer it to people, you know. This is a goal, but, you know, we can't really describe what it is. It's just, it's freedom of suffering. But to be driven by the goal is just another form of clinging. So the Four Noble Truths, if you really understand it, is a protection also that your involvement with spirituality doesn't itself involve clinging or fear or longing for something. Because rather it's to look back at the longing and the clinging and the fear and understand it directly. So we're always looking out for something else to provide the answer. And the Four Noble Truths says the answer lies inside of you. And you need to look in yourself in the present moment and not keep looking outside. You can do that for other reasons. There's other things to do in your life besides get rid of suffering, but But if you, what you want to do is to really understand suffering and be free of it, you have to really understand these Four Noble Truths. So there is suffering. The cause of suffering is driven desire. There's a possibility of bringing this kind of suffering to an end. And the Fourth Noble Truth is what's called the Eightfold Path. And this is more the instructions for the ways in which we can free ourselves from suffering. It's recognized that it's not easy to become free of suffering. It's not easy to let go of this kind of extra clinging that we add to the situation. And we have to have tremendous respect and compassion for ourselves in the work that it takes and in the confrontation and meeting with ourselves. It's not an easy thing to kind of wake up and to understand all this. So the Buddha then offered some pragmatic steps, some pragmatic useful tools to help us so we can have create the foundation to help so slowly we can have the greater insight and begin waking up more powerfully. And this is called the Eightfold Path. And the first of the Eightfold Path it has a lot to do with understanding the Four Noble Truths, understanding what they really are and how they really apply to our life, and understand how and to be motivated from that understanding. Because the importance of this is if you don't understand it, if you don't understand your own suffering, then it's very easy to look for solutions to it outside of the real cause of it. So for example, you know, if you feel really lonely, and so you have this tremendous clinging to what? Give me an example. What would you cling to if you were really lonely?
Somebody to love you.
You really cling to someone to love you. So, so I really want someone to love me. So I think I'm going to go to the psychic. And the psychic is going to tell me how to do that. And therefore free myself from the suffering. That's to look away from the cause itself, which is, I'm really lonely and the loneliness causes pain, and because I'm uncomfortable with my pain, I'm reaching out to cling onto something. I don't know if that was a good example, but we often import other things into try to help ourselves, which actually don't really have to do. They might give some relief. They might give us some hope, which is, you know, provides a kind of relief also. But they don't really address the real cause. So in Thailand, for example, in Buddhist countries, one example like this is people will go and get these amulets from Buddhist monks. And these Buddhist monks, some of them, you know, are kind of into making money, so they kind of do it. But some of them kind of just do it reluctantly. They're not really not into giving amulets to people, but people demand it from them, say, okay, we'll give you, here's some amulets, you know, but they don't count for much. But people want these amulets because they think it has magic power. And the magic of the amulet is going to somehow bring them happiness, free them of their suffering. That's the look in the wrong direction. And what Buddhism is really about is turning this mirror, well, part of what Buddhism is about is turning that mirror back to understand our own suffering. So the first of the Eightfold Path is to really understand the Four Noble Truths. Second is the Eightfold Path is to be let our motivation truly arise out of understanding those Four Noble Truths. The third is, fourth, and fifth have to do with living a life, an ethical life, that provides a kind of good foundation for developing deeper insight into the subtleties of our mind. You need to have a very strong foundation in right ethics, in being a kind of basically a decent person, if you want to let go of all security. Because if you are not an ethical person, you don't have the kind of inner strength to be able to kind of let go. And you have to have a kind of inner core strength. And being ethical provides that. So this involves all ethical things, but they involve right speech, paying attention to how we speak, paying attention to our livelihood, how we make our living. Is it really ethical the way we make a living? It has to do with our actions in the world. You know, are they really ethical? Do they follow some basic rules of decency where we don't hurt other people? And then there's such things as right engagement, you know, being engaged, putting effort into our spiritual life, putting effort into living ethically, and putting effort into being mindful and waking up. You can't become free of suffering unless you build, unless you apply your effort to doing that. You know, if you just kind of lay back and say, what's going to happen someday, you know, meditation's great, I think I'll sit down here and meditate, and someday it might happen if I just kind of sit here long enough. It's not going to get very far. There has to be some engagement in the process. Yeah. So this is the Eightfold Path. And the seventh is the practice of mindfulness. And the eighth is the practice of concentration, of real stability in the mindfulness. So cultivating these things makes it a lot, gives a kind of strength within us. Cultivating concentration, cultivating mindfulness, cultivating energy or engagement, cultivating ethics, cultivating motivation, and cultivating understanding, create an important strength, of a strong foundation, upon which it's a lot easier than to understand our suffering and learn how to let go of that drivenness at the roots of where it happens. Now, mindfulness practice exists within this context. And the function of mindfulness practice is not to suffer. And the function of mindfulness is not to ferret out all your suffering, not to look for it. You don't have to go out of your way to look for it or create it. But rather, the function of mindfulness is to learn how to pay attention to the present moment, so that when suffering arises in this present moment, you're there to notice it. And then to be interested in it, not to run away from it. Learn how to be comfortable with suffering. Learn how to be okay with it, so you don't lash out at it. Don't act inappropriately because of your discomfort. And then begin penetrating and begin learning the roots of it, the causes of it, letting go of the clinging, letting go of the interpretation. Oh, I don't have to interpret that life is falling down around me and this is one more thing, the tires, and I don't have to interpret these things this way. That's extra. It's okay, I let go of that. The training to be in the present moment then also helps us to be present for the joy that exists in life. There's a lot of joy in life also, a tremendous amount of joy. And part of the vision of awakening is not just simply a greater understanding of the suffering in the world, but also a greater understanding of the tremendous level of a layer of joy that's also a possibility in life that's here. And so, but we have to be in the present moment to really appreciate that joy also. So mindfulness is a training to appreciate what arises in the present moment and to really connect to it as it's happening. So connect to our suffering and connect to our joy, or in all the variations of it. I did the Spirit Rock Teachers yesterday. We had a meeting where we invited a psychologist to come and speak to us about the issues of abuse, because the feeling was we should have better understanding about the abuse issues and how the dynamics of abuse and the language is that of abuse and the victim, you know, how it functions in our society, and so that we can be a little bit wiser when meditation students come and maybe dealing with issues of abuse, and we need to be sensitive to those themes. And one of the things that struck me was what he said was that oftentimes people who are both in the abusive situation and the victim situation, really stuck in those two modes, often, not always, but often, those people sort of stuck in those two roles, in those two modes of being, both of them are probably tremendously uncomfortable or incapable of being present for discomfort, psychological discomfort or conflict within themselves. And so they deny and shut down their own discomfort and act out in the external world. The abuser, he said, is often someone who feels this tremendous conflict and discomfort within themselves, hasn't learned the skills and the techniques to really be present for themselves and kind of deal with it. So they can't face themselves, and so they blame the world out there. And one of the frightening things he said was that they did a study of children who were brought to hospitals from being physically abused or abused. And they studied the parent who had abused them, who beat them or something. And 90% of the time, the parent said it was the fault of the child. this phenomenal statistic. There was a fault of the child that they did it. And what he understood, how he understood that to be, is that the parent was so uncomfortable with their own inner, conflicted, painful situation, they didn't have the tools to look at it and be with it, that they had to find and blame their discomfort on something outside of them. And they believed it was true that the child was causing their suffering. They believed it. But it was really because they couldn't be with their own. And the victim, also people who are stuck in the victim mode, oftentimes there's a lot of denial. Oh, they kind of, oh, I'm responsible. You know, if I didn't do, if I only did it better, if I only cooked the dinner better, then it wouldn't have happened. And often there's a kind of, he argued, that often for the victim also, sometimes there's also a kind of an inability to stay present for real discomfort. And so they act out in unhealthy ways and end up staying in the relationship longer than they should because they blame themselves. I think it's a very dramatic example of the power of not learning to be comfortable with suffering. And part of what mindfulness does is a very powerful training in learning to be comfortable and balanced with whatever arises in the present moment. Whatever present moment wants to give you. If it gives you joy, learn how to be with it. Without what? Clinging to it. And if discomfort happens in the present moment, it's the same thing. Learn how to be with it without clinging to it. That is a phenomenally powerful and transformative thing to learn to do. And this is a lot of what mindfulness practice is about in its Buddhist kind of context. For a lot of people, of course, just sitting in mindful in meditation and just being mindful, it's just a wonderful way to kind of become a little bit calmer, let go of some of the tension. Suffering gets created in the present moment. And there's kind of, and if we kind of continue to be driven, which we often are, we keep recreating it. The function of meditation, in part, is to interrupt the drivenness. So to stop and sit and be quiet and just breathe mindfully and be with our breath, that means that we're not going to be with our stories and our drivenness as much. The breath is not drivenness. And so we kind of put a stop for a little bit to the drivenness. And if we stop being driven in the present moment, then we stop fueling the tension that arises and the stress that arises out of drivenness. And the body finally gets a chance to relax. And so part of what meditation does, it allows us to relax. And that from that relaxed stance, an easeful stance, it can be very joyful, it's a lot easier to go back and really study, and then more subtly, the ways in which we're still clinging. And as we study the more greater subtlety, we can release those. And that allows us to look a little more carefully. And then we release that more subtly. And as we get that lower and lower and more subtle, more actually delight and ease gets developed within us until we find that we don't have to cling to anything at all. Absolutely nothing. It's not in the operating instructions for being a human being that we have to cling. Except my baby, who was born clinging. The first thing he did, we have a photograph just after he was born. I mean, literally, he was full of blood and laying there. So it was like a second after he was born. And the first thing he did was he clinged onto the operating table. What I'm beginning to wonder now, watching this kid grow up, is whether part of what growing up means is learning to develop the kind of strength of presence and mindfulness that we learn that we don't need to cling anymore. And that the clinging that we do as adults is kind of a continuation, perhaps, of necessary survival strategies as babies, but which we're supposed to grow out of. So Buddhism is, again, very simple. Maybe it's not even a religion. Maybe it's just a way of growing up. So that was a mouthful. So I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do now. Should we sit, or should we take time for questions and process what I said a little bit?
Both?
Well, we can take, okay. Let's take 5 minutes for questions and comments and discussion. Yes?
It's not a question, it's just a realization. The first time that I've really seen the correlation between being in the present non-judgmentally as I'm making those decisions to not suffer. It's so much like actual meditation in that compassion of recognizing that I'm drifting, but gently pulling it back. So that there's a decision with my meditation. I'm so bad at it that, you know, in the time that we are attempting to meditate or I'm attempting to meditate, I mean, if there's one, there's 100 of times that I'm pulling myself back. And now I finally see the correlation between actual living and those decisions I could make at that moment to not put that filter on it or not put that interpretation on it, just to live that experience.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Got that.
And that's very important in the context of wandering away. A lot of people will, when they wander away in meditation, will interpret, "Oh, I've been a bad meditator," and they've added something which wasn't not part of the operating instructions. You don't have to say that. You know, you're just, "Oh, this is a human being who's wandered away. Isn't that interesting? Okay, let's get. I'm supposed to be back in my breath. Let's come back." And it can be done much. It can be done real, real compassion that way. Yes.
You talked about staying in the moment and keeping your awareness and concentration. I know it's funny because I found that I started listening in the past year to jazz when I'm in the city or the suburbs driving around. It keeps me really focused somehow, and I don't really hear it, so I wake up more. But when I'm in the country, and I grew up actually more in the country, I don't.
Interesting. What makes me wonder is when, for example, if life is really chaotic, then the medicine for that chaos would the medicine for that particular situation would be, in a situation of great stability and health, itself be a poison. So. When life is really chaotic, having something like this music you're playing might really be important and useful to bring you back to some degree of centeredness and presence. But if you're in the country and really present there, and you know it might be a great state of kind of health, then to have the jazz might actually be agitating. Mm-hmm. So it has to be where you're at.
Adjusting
to the environment. So it's a wise thing in some environment and not in the other. By the door.
It's so recently, you know, this idea of letting go of all this clinging stuff really, you know, seemed like a great idea. But so recently, the thought, you know, keeps popping up, but no, you know, these dialogues are me. And, you know, even though, you know, the Buddha says, like, you know, it's a good idea to let go of me, it somehow doesn't seem like such a good idea.
Because this clinging is who you really are.
Yeah.
And if you're not clinging, who can you possibly be? It's kind of like the experience of not knowing how to swim, and you get thrown into a pool of water, and you're flailing about until you realize all you have to do is relax, and the water holds you up. So what you need to learn is to relax, and you'll find out that the ocean of life will hold you just fine, without you needing to have a self. You'll know what to do. You'll take care of yourself. You'll take care of your people around you really beautifully without having to cling to some self.
Just trust.
Trust. And for me, the end result of the Four Noble Truths of Practice is a state of ultimate trust. Yes?
I'm just wondering, after your grand awakening, if that has also impermanence follows that.
Absolutely. It does and it doesn't. it depends what you're looking at. But as a psychic shift that happens the way it's experienced sometimes can actually be very short, brief. The experience of nibbana or enlightenment that happens can actually be very, very brief, but it's very, very powerful transformation. And there are things within us that get transformed permanently. But the state, the experience of clarity, the experience of luminosity, the experience of kind of being in touch with this deathless state might only last for a few seconds or a few minutes or a few hours because it itself is impermanent. But the clinging to a sense of self, for example, might be permanently lessened. So yes and no. Yes.
You have less clinging to a sense of self because you feel that the self keeps going anyway in some form. Like with some less clinging to self because it's indestructible in some way.
Well, this is metaphysics. If you want to talk metaphysics, and the Buddha says that that kind of notion of an indestructible self cannot be found. You can believe in it, you can theorize about it, but in your own experience you won't find it. And the Buddha was not interested in things you couldn't experience, because suffering and the freedom of suffering arises only in relationship to things that you experience. And that's all you need to know, is to really study that. You don't have to be concerned then. And there might be, and there might not be, some ultimate indestructible sense of self. There might be, and there might not be, a great, you know, creator God. But that's not relevant to the purpose of the Four Noble Truths. So you can be this wonderfully, you know, enlightened and at ease and generous and peaceful person, either as an atheist or as a theist. You know, you can, as you wish. That's why Buddhism is very generous about other religious traditions. It's, you know, it's all fine. In a sense, yes.
Is guilt a like first level suffering, or is it always sort of second judgment about something else?
Well, this is maybe we have to distinguish definitions. Guilt as a form of aversion to self, criticism of self, is a form of suffering, involves some extra level of interpretation or clinging or drivenness, something. Remorse, where if we've done something that we've hurt someone else, and we recognize the pain we've caused someone else, and we feel maybe empathetically, if you feel that pain, and to feel bad about that, to kind of feel that pain, to feel kind of a regret, to feel bad, this is not a good thing, you know. To go out and have a car accident, and run into someone else and put them in hospital for 2 weeks. And to get out of your car and go kind of whistling down the road and skipping, and say, things are just fine, all is one, and you know, whatever. That in Buddhism, but to feel some remorse or some regret, oh, this is a bad thing. I wasn't paying enough attention. I ran into this person. I feel bad. That is considered to be healthy in Buddhism. And that's just a direct contact. But to add on top of that guilt, to hate oneself or feel aversion towards oneself, is different than taking responsibility and feeling remorse.
I have something. It's just that every single death I've been involved with at the hospital, no matter what the circumstances, if they were in hospice, if they knew, they talked, every single one of the families, the people that loved that person,
very common. Very, very common.
It's almost like it's human
nature. Oh, I don't know. Maybe so.
But then I thought,
well,
maybe it's only
American. Yeah. I don't know. See, this, I don't. There's a lot of things I don't know, right? I just know one or two of those leaves, and so I don't want, you know, I don't really can't answer these questions myself in a kind of grand scheme of things. But my trust is in the practice itself. So my response to such a question is not to try to, you know, I don't know, I can give, you know, some kind of answers, but I don't really know, ultimately. But my interest would be not to get the answer from someone else, but rather to find out for myself through my own mindfulness practice. You know, how is it really for me? That's what's really interesting, that's what's important for me, is to do that study for myself, and find out in my particular situation, in the particulars of my life when they come up, is my guilt extra or not? If you talk about it in the abstract, it's very hard to find out. So there's a tendency in Buddhism not to, you don't believe it listening to me, but there's a tendency not to kind of want to generalize a lot, but rather throw it back onto the particular. And what does it say in a particular moment of your experience? Because that's where your suffering and that's where your freedom is going to happen. That's where you find out for yourself, and that's what you need to do. And then everybody else, you can study other people also in their particular situation. So now we have to do an instant meditation. Fast. So get ready. Put on your seatbelts. On your marks. Get set. Yes, the first person that gets to the finish line. It's okay. 1, 2, 3, breathe. Congratulations. What's very nice about mindfulness practice is we all get to now at the same time.